Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sand Job, the podcast where we read and review the entirety of Neil Gaiman's Sandman series of comic publications. We're so happy to be back here. I am one of your hosts, Iris J. Pronouns are she or zare, if you're feeling spicy. Why don't my hosts, co-hosts, introduce themselves as well?
I'm Nero, he, him, and I have a really good cup of hot chocolate.
Oh. I am Jesse, gender, sometimes known as Jesse Earl, she, they, and I don't have hot chocolate, but I have apple cider, which is very
ooh,
nice.
Also yummy.
Yeah. Hot really apple cider. It's very
autumn core in here.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. Even though it's almost spring, the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it's been a busy winter for all of us,
but
we're really happy to be back, and we're really happy to be discussing this, the third book in the Sandman series, a very short one, so we're going to be discussing the entirety of it today, Dream Country. Originally a collection of four short stories. They're basically like single-issue one-shots. Yeah, it's issues 17 through 20 in the original run. Each one kind of a different take on the world of the dreaming. Each one distinctly having different levels of how often the dream shows up in them. The fourth one, Dream, doesn't even show up in it at all. It features death instead, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it's like very, like of all the ones we've read so far, it's definitely the most anthology-based.
Yeah, it's world building. But, so to get into it, this was when I was younger, I don't remember this as being like, wow, that was wild, but more just as like an example of like the types of stories and also the art style in The Sandman constantly shifting over the course of its run. I do remember really liking the cat story, and rereading it now, I still really like the cat story. I'd like to go on record as saying that it was cool. But the first story in the book actually isn't about cats. It's about writers, a much grosser creature, in Calliope.
Definitely much grosser.
In Calliope, a struggling writer buys and imprisons an ancient Greek muse that he uses to prop up his writing career. But when the muse calls for the aid of her ex-lover Dream, things turn sour for the skeezy scribe.
Look at you in your intros.
Ooh, skeezy.
I know. I'm trying to up my game a little bit.
That's like that's a word that I haven't. You don't hear enough of skeezy. It's a
skeezy.
Fun word.
I collect weird, obscure English words. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a fun word.
Yeah, but yeah, this also is the first issue that Kelly Jones works on the pencils for. With Malcolm Jones III inking. And I like some of Kelly Jones's artwork. Mm-hmm. Other features of his artwork I'm not nuts about. I do like the heavy use of... I do like when the zip tones show up in this issue, and I like the heavy use of spot blacks. That's really fun.
What's zip tones again?
They're the little dots. Screen-printed dots.
Gotcha,
that are
gotcha,
like...
Gotcha.
Ways to kind of give sort of a nubbly texture to fields of color.
Interesting.
But yeah, what did y'all think of this story? How did you feel about this one?
It's one of those ones where, like, I think it could have used a stronger editorial hand because it kind of weenies out, you know? Like, if you want to do, like, this horrific story, then you should write the horrific story. And it just doesn't go all the way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I forget where it's noted, but there was a note that, like, the editor, Karen Berger, asked them to not make Calliope look so emaciated on the title page. And no, I think they should have kept that, but otherwise I feel like maybe she maybe needed to, I don't know. What do you two think?
Yeah, this story is one that is, it's really fucked up. Let's just be like clear about it. I mean, it's a dude like kidnapping a woman and then repeatedly sexually assaulting her very explicitly for his own like artistic desire. It kind of comes across as this like high-minded like thing of like, ooh, look, this is a deep thought on writers and how writers are constantly battling the muse. It feels like that very high-minded thing, but then it's also just like a deeply fucked up story that I don't think the story really wrestles with in any way. It's just sort of like,
No, I was going to say, this, my whole takeaway from the story that I didn't quite pick up when I was a teen because I was a lot more receptive to like edgy 90s Vertigo stuff back then. But this story really wants to have its cake and eat it too. It really wants to be like, ah, yes, this is a moody tone piece. But like, it never, we are supposed to see the story through the author's eyes. And whenever Calliope is shown, she's kind of just like, we never see her as anything but like a hotted boob woman. She's always like kind of this sexy and sort of like twisting into classic comic book guy poses and shit. It seems like it wants to like titillate the reader, even though the point of the story is that this is like, you shouldn't find this. We're trying to talk about this in a more nuanced mode than just this is horny. I don't know. It doesn't.
No. It's the conflicting sort of like viewpoints that the writer, that Neil Gaiman is trying to showcase, but not really having enough empathy for. In the sense that like there's the Vertigo impulse of like, hey, look, sexy boobed woman, and you can like kind of pity her as like this object of pity in the narrative. As a reader, we're sort of meant to pity her, but we're also kind of like meant to be titillated by her. Like, we see her boobs a bunch, we see shots of her like displayed nakedly and her butt showing. There's like very sexy poses when she's like by herself, and so she's just like this object of pity. And I make very clear the use of the word object of pity in the narrative. And then even within the story itself, like, she is just an object used by the writer. And then Sandman just kind of comes out of his own like will and like, and just like, yeah, I'll come and save you. And it's like about him and his sort of feelings about like, I need to save her, and we're dealing with like his emotions about all of this, not really hers. And we don't really get an insight into her. So it's just like, it's just a bunch of like dudes both whacking off to the story and within the story itself. It's just like a bunch of like just dealing with them. Yeah. And the reason that this is like made most explicit to me, just to point out, is I don't know if you watched the TV show version of it.
No, we haven't. No.
Well, without spoiling, I actually don't dislike the TV show version of it. It's similar, though they downplay some of the sexual assault elements a little bit, which is better. And she's also clothed, which is also better. But the better thing, too, is Calliope is much more defiant, and she's the one that kind of, like, calls and forces and demands that Sandman saves her. So it's still got That's issues cool. of, like, dude coming to save a woman, but like Calliope is given much more agency in that version of the story.
I was going to ask for a point of clarification. Was this part of the first season, or is the second season already out on Netflix by this point?
It was part of, they did like a surprise episode after the season came out. They did the 10 episodes, which ended at the end of last issue, and then like 2 or 3 weeks after the season came out, they're like, surprise, we've got a whole nother episode for you. And it adapted Calliope and also Dream of a Thousand Cats.
Oh, weird. I didn't know that. Nobody ever talked about that. Interesting.
Yeah, it was just like a surprise, like, hey, here's an extra episode, why not?
Okay, sure.
Interesting. Okay, so I do have to ask, Jesse, does your version have the script in the back?
No, it does not.
Okay, because that makes some of this interesting, because, like, the version that we have is kind of padded out with like a, yeah. I think it's like 20 or 30 pages of just the script for Calliope.
Right. For listeners, this is the trade paperback version of yes. Dream Country. I believe Jesse is reading from an annotated anthology, so it wouldn't have this because it's mm-hmm. it's organized into like several larger volumes rather than each individual arc.
Yeah.
And because this book is so, like, it's only four issues of comics, they had to make it look like it was worth buying at a comic little, book shop somehow.
A little chunky.
So they put the
chunkier.
Yeah, they put the script for Calliope in the back of the book. Which, you know, in the intro to it, Neil is like, I don't like showing off my magic tricks. But I'm like, nah, it's fine, homie. Show us how you do it. I want to see all the guts. I want to see how the sausage gets made, bucko.
Well, the reason I bring that up is also because, like, the script for like the original shot that shows off Calliope says that it's specifically not supposed to be titillating and that it's supposed to, like, draw inspiration from photos of famine or concentration camp victims. And it's like, Neil, they didn't hit it at all.
Yeah.
This didn't work.
Boy, that's like that is a choice to draw from. Oh God.
Yeah, like it's supposed to first off, she's apparently supposed to be 15 or 16, which they do not tell you.
I mean, she's technically supposed to be like hundreds of thousands of years old. But
listen,
it's also that
she's
sort of like,
thousands
it's okay,
of years
it's,
old. She just looks
okay.
15.
Yeah, it's like it's okay because she's actually thousands of years old. So you can have your weird like pedophilia stuff. Ugh, God, gross.
But it's also like she doesn't look 15. She
no.
looks like fully like she is based on. I think they mentioned somewhere in the script, and I'm missing where it is. I should have highlighted it. But they modeled her after a specific actress who
it
is
feels,
like an adult.
It feels like that same. It feels like that like Lolita impulse of like dude writers that is just like, oh, we're so deep because we're talking about the virginalness of a young and of hotness of a young woman.
Yeah,
you know, is there 15 and 16? And to be clear, like people very much misunderstand Lolita as a novel, and it's kind
oh
of
absolutely
about that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still like that sort of like kind of pretentious, self-indulgent, like, ooh, the virginal nature of a woman, she has to be 15, 16, ugh. And then,
yeah.
like, adding Holocaust image, like, intentional Holocaust imagery into that is, like,
yeah.
a weird choice.
It's like, be horrifying or don't, like, it's just, and, like, specifically, like, citing those as, like, I mean, I guess this is, when did this come out? Was this 19,
But, like,
1990.
Bimbo-fying Holocaust imagery
yeah.
is a decision.
it's not a good decision.
No.
it's very odd. I don't know. I'm curious about the TV version.
The TV version, actually, again, it's one of those, like, you are trying to polish up a very problematic story. So, like, it's always going to have the bones of, like, a dude has to come and save a woman narrative, and she's sort of being used for men. And, like, that's
yeah.
just core to what this story is. But
yeah.
if you are going to update that story, I think the TV show did about as good as you possibly could. And it
right.
also did add in, like, it added in some other, like, subtle commentary, too. Like, in the comic here, we get, like, bits of, like, this guy becoming successful and,
yeah.
like, going into Hollywood and stuff like that. And it just, like, sort of says, like, look, he's successful now. Isn't that a thing? But in the show, they also add in... the guy, when he does become successful, he is seen as, like, a progressive writer in Hollywood and starts talking about, like, we need to treat women better.
That's in the...
Is it?
Oh, yeah. He talks at a party about how he tends to regard himself as a feminist writer.
Yeah.
Okay, he does have
which,
that. Yeah.
Which is
okay,
great, which is
that.
Very funny.
Okay, good. So they do have that content, which I actually do like that element of it. So
yeah,
because it does sort of speak about like how men in some spaces can still like, oh, I'm the feminist, like very like Joss Whedon energy.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
oh, I'm writing good women, like strong women characters, but like just perpetuating the same sort of cycle and getting the pat on the back.
Yeah,
so very much the Joss Whedon vibe.
Yeah, yeah. It's also got some very weird looking art in it.
Some of the art I like, some I don't. But
I like some of the more stylistic choices, like of the original, like the Richard Maddox writer. I think it was like his like very like evil, like, face was cool.
God, yeah, he looks a classic, like, 50s, like, EC Comics, like, horror guy. Like a character who would show up in Crypt Keeper. I did like that quite a bit.
I think the first thing that I was thinking was the, when the muses show up, it's extremely difficult to tell Calliope apart from one of the other muses, and it confused me for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know why we decided to go with big, puffy 80s Farrah Fawcett hair for both of them.
Because it was the 80s.
Ladies, where are you getting that styled? But yeah, they did the same thing with the muses switch places in every panel to show that they're interchangeable. I feel like it wasn't pushed as far here. I don't know. It seems like they were a little afraid to make it too stylized, but I feel like more stylization would have helped. So this is a mild thing. I do appreciate that, like, I mentioned, like, the hard blacks on the characters. Like,
yeah,
you can kind of tell when characters are sort of hiding something or are feeling like they're like thinking about something really kind of dark by that shadow on their faces or stuff like that. Whereas when they're in more public situations, when they're talking to others, there's less of that. Like, you only really get those deep shadows when they're really lost in themselves, which is it's a nice touch. I will say sometimes that leads to some unusual paneling choices, but it's also notable that Dream, when he shows up in this issue, gets that treatment from front to back, which I also want to shout out. While the art in this issue is kind of like all over the board, Dream's fit in this issue, fucking awesome. Love the high-collared leather jacket. That hair.
The one shot where he's like staring at the dude is amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh my god. That's like, yo.
And how it becomes like his like ragged like cloak like by the end. Like, it looks great.
That's fucking cool. He just sort of dissolves like a ghost. Very neat.
I did like the sequence where the author character has too much information in his brain and is having like a public meltdown, and like the lettering gets all like jumbled. Like, it looks great.
Yeah. He's coming up with too many hot pitches. He's coming up with too many elevator pitches.
His brain is so big.
Oh. The great thing too is that like most of the pitches are like nothing. They're like just like loose fragments, but I think it's more that his brain is reading them all as this could be the next big thing. Like, it's not so much he has ideas in abundance, it's that he can't tell the difference between a good idea and a bad one anymore, and most of them are just like bullshit.
Yeah
Well, I see it as more just like that, like the feeling that you get when like you have a really cool idea that you're excited about, and you's like you kind of like, oh, if I develop that further, this could be like the next big thing, but you like then you get like excited by the next thing and the next thing. It's like, I don't necessarily, I'm always of the opinion like you can make any idea good, you just have to like really work on it and develop it, and this he's just not getting that because he's just zipping around.
I will curse you with a new type of ADHD called super ADHD.
No.
Oh god.
No.
Yeah. But yeah, those panels are cool. I like the panel edges are super ragged too, to kind of like, it's very it's, you don't see that effect show up again in the comic. It's only in this issue, which is kind of cute.
Yeah. And I did also like the sequence of Dream fading away on the last page as the guy is losing his ideas. That's a good touch.
That was cool. Yeah, there's a lot of little stuff to like about this story. It's just that they're in this story, and this story is very, like,
as a whole, it needed more time in the cooker, you know?
Which, damn, you know, Neil, this one could use some work.
The TV show does better, at least, thankfully. Okay. So, there you are.
Do we want to move on to A Dream of a Thousand Cats?
Hell yeah,
I want to talk about A Dream of a Thousand Cats.
Fuck yeah. So in The Dream of a Thousand Cats, there's a secret gathering of cats, and at it, one lone Siamese tells a story of how she found, from the Dream King, that felines once ruled the planet, and how they might one day rule it again. Okay, so it's Kelly Jones on art, and first off, to get this out of the way, some of the models for the, like... My man loves a photo reference of a cat, and you can tell, he's working from photo reference, that's cool, and, you know... Because we're artists, we're all drawing people more often than we're drawing anything else. Some of the cats kind of shift their, how they look a little bit over the course of the story. But that's really the biggest critique of the art in this one that I maybe have. There's a lot
I actually thought that was intentional. That, like, really? The cats, like, kind of shifted, a little, kind of, like, adding to that sort of dream-esque feel to it. And, like, how, like, this reality is not entirely real. Like, I thought the look of them changing subtly was intentional. That's,
like,
that's
the big one that I think of is, like, the very first page. Like, the third panel that has the main kitten looking very cute, and then the bottom, like the sixth panel, like that looks like a totally different cat to me.
Fair enough, yeah.
I don't know, it felt a little odd, but also it was the 80s.
I could also see Jesse's argument where it's like the cat looks very cute when we're seeing it from the perspective of the humans, but when it's seen from the perspective of another cat, it looks more mature and like more like an animal.
Yeah.
So I think there is some credence to that idea, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that could be a stylistic choice. But yeah, I really like the art in this one. It incorporates more like mixture of textures. I like the dry brushwork that happens on a lot of the blacks. Malcolm Jones tried to push a little bit more of that in this. That especially combined with the really, some of the inks on some of the cats are like really needle sharp and good looking. They're real nice.
And did love Dream as a cat.
Cat Dream is a fursona. We know what Dream's fursona is. Fucking amazing. Love that. Like, what did you think about the story, too?
I love the concept at the end of... basically what gets explained is that humans used to be like cats were. They were sort of like much smaller. They were sort of pets, and cats would eat them and treat them terribly. It is like pets, and things for food, and humans sort of went around preaching, like, if we all dream together, we can sort of change the world into what we want it to be. And one day they did, enough humans did dream, not all humans, but enough humans, and the world became as it is now. And I love the distinction that it's like, oh, the world didn't change, it just always was that way now because of this. And I love that, like it's like, oh, there was no like past where the cats like ruled, it just never happened. And I thought that was just a cool, like, dream logic-y sort of thing. Yeah, that I thought was just a really clever idea.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I'm very biased towards this story as someone who grew up reading, like, oh god, what was that Tad Williams cat book?
The not Warrior Cats, it's the other one that you keep talking about, though. It's like the Lonesome Road or something.
No, that's Wild Road, and that's by somebody Wild else. Road. Tail Chaser's Song is the one I'm thinking of. I love me a kitty cat book.
Yeah, it's a story about the transformative power of stories, but also it's kind of about like the other sort of ongoing theme of Sandman that I feel like people talk less about, which is that. The little everyday amounts of violence that some of us just sort of take for granted mean a whole lot to other people and can really lead to unexpected consequences and unexpected changes in people's lives. To the people living in this neighborhood, this probably... who didn't know that this was happening, like, this probably was like any other thing. Like, the story about the cat leading the sermon is a very sad one. She gets her kittens taken away from her and tossed in a river because the owners don't want them because they're not purebred Siamese. Ooh. And her owners are dicks. But
they're also like, oh, well, she probably doesn't understand. It's whatever. Don't worry about it.
Exactly.
And it's like,
no. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, this is one of those stories that I think does... discussion of discrimination, and you could even plop it onto like any sort of like systemic injustice and like racialization or anything mm-hmm. like that, in a way that is, I think, really well done, because it doesn't make it like clearly, oh, hey, we're going to make this metaphor about cats about black people or queer people, for example. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make that mm-hmm. one-to-one, but it sort of takes its own premise to its full, like, just takes it this premise like is on its own terms, but because mm-hmm. there's enough parallels with other things going on, we can understand and see where these connections are about like systemic injustices that we just take as normal, how we dehumanize and see people as less than, like saying the cat's like, oh, she won't understand, like there's clearly like people who dehumanized people's like, oh, they won't understand if we separate them from families. We saw that during slavery, for example. It's a way to showcase those injustices without it being like a one-to-one where it's like, this is about this thing. To say that those stories aren't valuable sometimes, and I think there are places that has done really well where you do have it be very intentional, but often times when that happens, the metaphor tends to have problematic implications to it, and that it can sort of like reveal a bias in the power structure in terms of who writes it. Like I think of like Star Trek episodes where it's just like they did episodes about race, but it's like, but both sides are equally got wrong points. So it by sort of bypassing that, I think this story is made stronger because of that.
Yeah, I agree. And also I think it's interesting that springboarding off of that, I think it's interesting though, the four stories in this collection are all very different. Mm-hmm. All of them ultimately have something to do with female agency, about what kind of stories we tell about women and to women, but never by women. Even when we get into Facade, that's a story that is a story that Urania herself didn't start writing. It was really more imposed upon her. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, like you could call that, oh, it's a failing of the writing at the time. But also on the other hand, like the whole point of this podcast, the whole point of reading stuff like this years after the fact, is to pick apart meaning and stuff that maybe people at the time didn't quite see. So I think that's mm-hmm. that's interesting. And even here with like this cat trying to essentially regain control of her own agency, regain control of the world around her in a very literal sense by just trying to ask as many cats as possible to imagine a better world, even if it would not be a better world for us, to be clear, from the perspective of cats, imagine a better world. Then that's a really interesting approach towards that one method of kind of dealing with that loss of agency. I will say that, like, from a more leftist perspective, of course, imagining doesn't get you anywhere without direct action. And I think that maybe the cat should consider at least unionizing on a local, regional level, maybe.
Cats should unionize to actually catch people's tongues.
Possibly.
See how they like it.
Yeah. Demonstrating some direct action, it does get the goods. But yeah, no. Great story. Really cool. Mm. Cool art, too. I love the... What is it? The Field of Bones.
Yeah.
Mm. That was so neat.
That's really good.
I don't know if you noticed, but the raven in this one with the skull face, different raven than Matthew.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting that. Mm. Oh, well.
Something to think about.
Much to thonk about. Anyways, for the next one.
Yeah, are we good? Do we want to hop to the next one?
Was there anything else we wanted to talk about with A Dream of a Thousand Cats? I will also say that the cover to this one is my favorite cover out of the four of these.
Mm.
It's like a good cover. It's a picture frame with part of it taken away and a cat jumping out of the frame, kind of. It's very cool.
Yeah. Oh. The only other thing that I would say about this one is I do like that Cat Dream does sort of like give the cat his blessing to sort of like, yeah, go forth and try and preach and try and change things to what they were with the cats in charge again. And it kind of goes to like Dream doesn't really have an allegiance to humanity or even a strong tie to humanity specifically. It's still at, even at this point in the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if he does that out of like pity or out of like just seeing what'll happen or just because he is Dreams, so like that would be the advice he gives. Like that is literally like I had a fantasy and I'd like to see it be made reality. It's interesting.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different ways you could read that that choice.
Yeah.
It's also a minor quibble going back to one of our previous conversations, but it's one of those things we're seeing Dreamcat, it's like, okay, so why is he by default a white guy?
If he can see if into a cat, he can see if into other looking people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let's hop on to the next
Anyways, issue 19 in 1990, A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is the one that won, I believe, was it the Hugo or the Nebula? I think it was the Hugo.
Oh, was this the one where it won a Hugo and then they were like, we're never letting comics in again?
We can't let Hugos win the grand prize. We can't let comics win the grand prize ever again. That is ridiculous. Jerks. I think Hugo's have a category for comics now, which is nice.
I believe so.
It's a similar situation to like the Oscars making the best animated film category so that we don't have them tainting the sacredness of prose.
Yeah, it's a best graphic story or comic.
That's cool that we have that representation, but I want to go toe-to-toe with the big boys. I want to take George R.R. down a peg.
Get his ass.
I get his ass. He shouldn't get too comfortable with all that Elden Ring money. I'm coming for you, Georgie.
Taking down the big Elden Ring boy.
Yeah. Enemy felled. But yeah, this is what did I have the synopsis for this? A young William Shakespeare performs his new play for Dream and an audience of characters from the mystical realm of fairy, including the characters of the play. Wow! The play in question is A Midsummer Night's Dream. And this issue will be exponentially better if you are at least somewhat familiar with the plot of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's an ancient Europe. There are a pair of lovers. They're star-crossed and also fighting. There's fairies, and a guy turns into a donkey. There's a love potion. Shit goes sideways, but it's a comedy, so everybody ends up happily ever after. There you go. I used to be very into Shakespeare, if you can believe it.
To be honest, I was never a big Shakespeare person. I like this story a decent amount, but I was just always like, yeah, yeah, it's a writer writing about Shakespeare, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's very dense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because this is a follow-up of Men of Good Fortune, where Dream mentions the deal that he made with Will in exchange for fame, where Will has to write one play about dreams at the start of his career, and then another play about dreams at the end, which results in the story The Tempest, which we won't get to for a while. Oh. But yeah, it is cool that they kind of show him as like kind of this like fallible sort of youngish guy who's like really, really wrapped up in himself to the point where like his son complains that like he doesn't really give a shit about anything other than making stuff. And he really just, other than, like, a few points where he, like, falters a bit, like, he just regards this whole shit with the fairies as, like, well, it's just another performance. The show must go on. Come on, guys, let's go. Which is interesting. Dream's fit in this is not as good. It's just okay. The bad hair is back. I think the high boots are cool. Charles Vess is doing the art on this one, and Charles Vess is like a titan of doing like weird, very florid fantasy type comics like this. Like, he did a bunch of adaptations of old like I believe it was Germanic Myths. He did the magic comic adaptation of The Magic Flute.
He collaborated with Ursula K. Le Guin for Books of Earthsea, right?
Like, I think so, yeah.
I can definitely, yeah, they definitely look like the covers of those books. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was I thinking of P. Craig Russell for The Magic Flute? I forget. Charles Vess worked on some fantasy shit. He also did a side story to Bone, which was weird. He did the origin story of, I want to say her name is Rose in the books. He did like a side graphic novel about that, which usually isn't included in the omnibuses because it's like, it's external material. But interesting to see him draw Jeff Smith characters. If you can find a copy of that, look for that. Yeah, I think he does good in this. He usually works in like watercolor type stuff, so it's weird to see his work translated to like ink and comic book colors.
I think they had somebody else on colors, didn't they? Or was it just all him?
It's Steve Olaf on colors. It's Charles Vess on pencils and inks.
Yeah.
Because they're like, it is colored like you would color any comic of the era with a lot of like gradients and like big flat patches. And this is like one of those instances where I almost feel like more modern, like kind of muted coloring might actually have done it a little bit of a better service. But also like that's the nature of what they could do at the time.
Well, I also wonder, looking at like more of his work after reading this, I do wonder if he quoted them for fully painted pages and they were like, haha, no way.
Oh, I could see that too. I could really see that too.
I could also see it from like a deadline standpoint too. Like,
yeah, that would also take fucking forever. It was just still like a really great excuse to get a new guy in and finally boost the rather low count in this that the series has been in, a slump really of weird little guys. There are so many weird little guys in this issue.
Yeah, because it's his troupe putting on A Midsummer Night's Dream, the play for various fey folk who like the play is kind of about. So I love that they all have like their little opinions.
Yeah, we get like MST3K riffing on the play.
Yeah.
And also like, it's great that like in the play everybody's just kind of like, oh, they're just like people wearing little flower crowns, but in real life they're like, oh no, they're monsters. They're like weird fucked up like creatures and shit. There's like
I love their outfits too. The fairies outfits are so great.
Yeah,
I did love the little one who was like, what's wrong with having an animal head? What's wrong with you? And she's like a little goat head lady.
Yeah, go on, tell me what's so funny. But it is funny because she says that and then literally two panels later she's like, besides, if you ask me, none of those women are women at all. They're males, I can tell. Human males taste more like rabbit than the females, and they stick in your teeth. Oh, yes. Also, the males are hairier and they lack the flesh on their chests. So we're talking about, like, gender essentialist fucking...
Yeah, little turvy goat, goat person.
But only during dining.
Yeah, listen.
You know, listen, I feel turfs deserve representation too, and I feel like this is
we, you know, we got spells for that. We got molecular gastronomy. Don't worry about it, lady. yeah, it's interesting too because like this, like again, when I say that the play really assumes that you know the play already, like it just kind of shows brief flashes of the actual stuff going on stage, intercut with the audience talking, Dream conversing with Oberon and Titania, and the actors conversing behind the stage sets while the play is going on, you know, between costume changes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is I think that it's a pretty cool way to keep the story feeling more kinetic than just a play performance.
Yeah.
It doesn't give us very deep looks into any of the characters in play here. Probably the most insight we get into it is maybe of Will Shakespeare himself, and also of... we learn a little bit about, like, Will Shakespeare's son, Hamnet. But not like just enough to characterize him as like, oh man, this kid probably has kind of a shitty life. And like when this was what Dream was talking about when he said that, like, oh, I'm giving this guy what he thinks he wants, whereas he's the price of it isn't really evident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also connected with Calliope in that it's about artists who kind of get overtaken by their desire to succeed in their work.
Neil has a subject that he likes very much.
Yeah, which is weird for a dude who's a successful writer, right? You really have some sort of weird, deep-seated guilt complex about this, huh, my man?
Are you afraid, Neil?
Are you afraid of what you yourself have created? Does God stay in his heaven because he too fears his own creation?
Yes, he does. He's scared.
Wow.
Oh, I did like the last page of Puck descending into the darkness after he's decided to be a little chaos twink out in the world. Good for him.
I love, too, that entire page is just dialogue from the play. No extra shit in there. Straight up last lines of the actual play.
Good
Very
stuff.
Classy. That was so cool. Puck is a little shithead in this. I love him. He's a gross little goblin, man. Absolute sicko. Great dude.
A little scamp.
Yeah. A little scamp. He's
just a little guy. It's his birthday. You wouldn't hit a little guy on his birthday, would you? People talk about him in this, like, other fairies talk about him like he is a fucking, like, axe murderer or something. It's really great. There was a lot of, like, Terry Pratchett energy going on in this issue, which I thought was really fun.
Oh, I can see it for sure.
I also liked him at the end being like, oh, yeah, we didn't get our gold. It was just this flowers shit in here. We got cheated. But then they're like, yeah, we got to perform for a bunch of little demon dudes. What are you talking about? We got paid. Yeah. That was great.
The payment is we got to perform the play for the people in it. That's nuts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I thought it was good. I thought out of all four of these stories, it was my second favorite behind the Cats one. And it was, I think it's especially interesting if you have even like passing interest in like Shakespeare stuff, because it's like, oh yeah, cool. It's it's Shakespeare fan fiction. How dope is that? Also, before we move on, I do also want to mention that while I'm not a huge fan of Dream's fit, I gotta say King Oberon's fit in this, the red armor and the horns, that's popping. Yeah. That's great.
So good.
That's cool. Looking great. I'm excited. You don't really get to see a ton of the world of fairy in the mainline Sandman series, but what you do see is really interesting. I'm excited to get to more of it later on down the line. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about with this issue?
No,
I think it was good. I also agree that it's like my second favorite behind the Cats one.
Kitties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Finally, last but not least, is Facade. In this one, a depressed and disfigured D-lister begs for death, but when death arrives, her answer isn't quite what she expects. This is a depressing one.
This is one of those ones where I read it and then I asked you, Iris, like, is this a character that like other people already know about? Because like, what is going on? And you were like, yes, it is.
Yeah. Element Girl is her name.
Yeah. And this is one of those things like British comic writers in the 80s and 90s love to do, where they dug their hand deep into the grab bag of weird-ass, exceptionally minor DC characters, yoinked one out, and were like, I'm going to deconstruct the shit out of you. You're going to be nothing but story
my little
atoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to be my little meow meow now. That's Alan Moore did it with Swamp Thing, and that's how he got famous as a writer. And then he did it again with Watchmen, which were originally characters from the Carlton Comics stable. Urania here, Element Girl, essentially started as the female counterpart to another hero called Metamorpho, who is slightly less obscure. You still see him
pop up. I've never heard of him.
Yeah, you still see him pop up from time to time. His thing is he can turn into every element. That's his whole thing. And that's also Element Girl's thing. But, you know, he's nobody's favorite these days. And Element Girl just doesn't show up at all. I think the last time I saw her in, like, a modern comic was, like, a comic that Mike Allred did with Metamorpho in it, which, like, Mike Allred's whole thing is, like, he loves doing comics that are, like, kind of very, like, 60s influenced, very, like, retro consciously throwback, and mm-hmm. that, like, including her was kind of part of that. But honestly, I don't think it would be exaggerating to say that this is probably the most significant story that she's ever been in.
That
sucks because it's not a fun one.
it's a very depressing. I mean, like, it's an interesting, like, deconstruction of her about, like, why it would be hellish to have these powers and, like, live forever and, like, be isolated from everybody. But it does kind of have, like, this whole, like, yeah, you should be able to die by suicide.
Yeah. She mentions the theme song to MASH in it. Suicide is painless.
Yeah. You hear about MASH?
Yeah. It is a... Again, similar to Calliope, like, it's weird to try to figure out whether this story, what it wants to do with this, because, like, I feel mm-hmm. like it doesn't, while I get what the angle is, which is that, like, a woman in despair actually finds comfort and solace in talking to death, because death is, like, nothing if not empathetic, I just feel like the Silver Age comic book elements of it are kind of detract from that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. while once the trick of, oh, this is a character that real comics heads are going to know about, nobody else, but this still takes place in the DC universe. Wow. Once that kind of wears off, it feels like it just gets in the way. I feel like if they wanted to push that angle too, I have a hard time believing that even in a world fucking jam-packed with, you know, metahumans, that this lady wouldn't be able to find absolutely jack shit anybody to confide in or hang out with or anything. A much more interesting story would be about forming some kind of like a support network for this kind of thing.
But exactly. That's exactly my thing with this. Like, I struggle a lot with this issue, a lot, because, like, I think it actually, like, for the first, like, most of this comic, it nails, I think, a good picture of, like, how, you know, our society isolates people, how she is very self-hating because of who mm-hmm. she is. Like, I think it, like, is a very good portrait of that. And I even like the bits about, like, death being empathetic and saying, like, hey, you know, I wasn't here for you, I was here for someone else, and, you know, like, there you can make a connection, and like, death being the one that, like, she's able to, like, get that from, it mm-hmm. sort of metaphorically mm-hmm. being, like, you know, someone who is suicidal, sort of, you know, ruminating on death and kind of being close and thinking about death is empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of that is very well articulated, but then it ends on her actually dying, and I really feel like that's a kind of fucked up poeticizing of dying by suicide, and I don't really enjoy that at all. It really feels like, oh, Neil Gaiman wanted to have, like, his, like, again, it kind of has that pretentious, like, look at me being all poetic and shit, she's gonna die, and it's gonna be so meaningful, and I'm like, but no, but it kind of just romanticizes that in a really kind of fucked up way, and, like, death, it kind of makes me dislike death in the final moments, too, with, like, being like, look, she's died, you know, and it's just, like, I would have much rather, like, this whole story have happened, and then her being, like, not dying. In fact, I even really liked the final, like, her final sentence of, like, is, like, I never realized that the sun is just a mask, too, and it's beautiful. Like, she seems to finally have a will for life at the final minutes and then, like, dies, and it just, like, it's... Yeah, I struggle with this story because I think it actually is not bad until the final moment.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I agree. And to be clear, I'm not saying that like you can't write stories about suicide. You can even write stories that argue that. Not that I would necessarily agree, but you know, I've read stories that are like, yeah, like being able to choose when you go. You know, that's not the worst thing in the world. That being said, like, it, as much empathy as death has for Urania, the readers are not supposed to have, it's like, it doesn't intend us to have that kind of same empathy. The ending just feels like a very, like edgelord cop-out.
Yeah. It really feels like that they didn't know how to fucking end it. And they were like, okay, well, I guess she dies then. All right, we're done. Turn the pages in.
Yeah.
You know? It does sort of feel like it does feel very much like, again, the writer being like Neil Gaiman being like, again, very poetic. Like, oh, it's going to be so deep. Like, she's going to die right when she discovers like that there's some joy in the universe that she can relate to other people because the sun is like the way she can relate to the world. And she finally catches that. And then she dies because of she wanted to die by suicide. Oh, how tragic. And I'm like, but that just feels like really depressing and fucked up. And it's like the better choice, I think, would have been to like at the last minute, like she's about to die. And then like she actually does like go out and like, you know what? I am going to try and make a connection from this experience. You know, I feel like that.
Right.
That would have been a much more hopeful message, but here it just sort of feels like misery porn and mm-hmm. It doesn't really work for me.
Right. It's weird. It starts as a good character study and then they have to finish the story and then it goes bad.
Yeah.
I will say Colleen Turan's art for it is good in most places. There are a few faces that are weird looking.
They definitely feel weird on purpose.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
they are very weird. I like the way she draws arms. That's all I was gonna say.
Yes.
Yeah. There's nothing unlike all the other comics where there's at least a panel where I'm like, oh, I really like this stuff. Like there's nothing here that I'm like particularly drawn to at any point.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I do like.
Sorry.
I do like the one perspective shot where like her face falls in the pasta. Like I thought
that bit was great. That's yeah. Good. Oh, that okay. That page was killer. I agree. Mm-hmm. Because it really hammered home like, oh, we're watching this through her eyes. Shit.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then also my favorite two pages in the whole bit were the sort of the dream sequence flashback that show her going originally finding the orb of Ra.
And Ra squanching her.
Yeah, Ra comes to life out of essentially like a tomb painting and turns into a huge bird guy who basically reshapes her in his hands like she's clay.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only time in the issue where they break sort of perfect 90 degree angles on all the panels, and they're kind of more jumbled and weird with these sort of hieroglyphic borders on them.
Yeah.
And the inking gets a little messier. That's really cool, and I think that's a great way to make it pop against the rest of the story. I know that Urania is probably very depressed about her whole life situation, but I'd like to go on record to say that Ra is a daddy, and I would let him do this to me. I would let him squunch me into whatever shape he wanted, and I would thank him afterwards.
He's going to squunch you into a ball and then just do a sick dunk like in the 90s.
That's fine. I'll help with your snake problem. That sounds great. Ha ha. And then what?
I did also want to mention, okay, I think the colorist on this is, it's the same guy it's been for the previous few ones, right?
Yeah, let me check that real quick.
Steve Olaf, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Olaf.
It takes, a lot of skill to make, like, that, like, weird baby pink work, in the restaurant scene. Like, I know you can't see it in your version, Jesse, but, like, the restaurant is, like, the most garish color of pink, but yet it works. Like, it's very impressive.
I feel like the pink is garish on purpose because it makes it feel uncomfortable. Like, it makes it feel super in contrast with the rest of the issue. It feels clean, bright, overly feminine. There's definitely like a performing femininity angle you could read into with this issue.
Yeah. Here, I put it one of the pages in the chat, and you can see kind of the shade of pink that they went with.
I do kind of like that idea, like the performing femininity angle, because she's like, she is kind of like, you know, in her mind, disfigured and ugly, and she wants to appear very feminine, and she can't.
It's great too, because like her whole shit has to be completely faked, because she talks about how like, you'd think if you could turn yourself into anything, the easiest thing in the world would be to transmute yourself into flesh, right? No, I tried it once, never again. I couldn't get rid of the smell for weeks. Rotten meat. Silicate faces are easier to manage, okay? Okay, it hardens eventually and falls off after a day or so, but at least it doesn't rot. And you can use the empty faces for useful things, things normal people have. Making real hair is easier. Mostly I use metals. It looks fine as long as nobody touches it. Nobody ever does. Which is so, like, it's wild how she has to make herself way more artificial in order to get to the base level of passing. So I think that's, you could draw parallels there, but it's not as clear cut as that, because like it's not like she chose to be like this. She was literally like ordered by the fucking CIA to do this.
If we're making the connection anyways, I feel like, you know, trans people don't choose that either.
Exactly. Like, that's what I mean.
But so I feel like you could read that metaphor in there quite a lot, especially.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And anything, which didn't go further to the like fucked up ending.
It's weird too, because like even in the panels that we're talking about with the very pink restaurant, Urania is talking to her friend Della from the agency about just petty life stuff. And Della mentions that she's going to have a kid, but she's afraid of the kid coming out disfigured. And she mentions this right as a group of disfigured kids walk by outside the restaurant. She's like, what if my baby's a freak? Ooh. And Urania's like, they're just people, Della. They aren't freaks.
And I also like that the kids that are like you know, disabled are actually shown to be like really happy, like they're having a birthday party.
Yeah, like, I want to point out that like there's a gang of them. They're having a nice day. They're together, and it's kind of like this is there. You almost made the connection that it's like you're never alone. It can be hard to live with stuff like this, but you can find solace in community. The story never seems to really connect A to B to C there.
No, it doesn't. And I think the other thing too with it is it's the typical like cis duty take of like, oh, isn't it sad that they have to deal with this? It's like the attempting to be empathetic, but ultimately condescending, sort of like, oh,
yeah,
you have it so hard. Disfigured people have it so hard. If we make the extrapolation, like trans women have it so hard that like, I feel like Neil Gaiman falls into quite a lot when he writes anyone who isn't like a cis dude, especially in this era of his writing, where it's like women have it hard. Trans women have it hard, which will get explicit in like future comic issues where he has a lot of empathy, but it's ultimately kind of like the very condescending cis dude.
He has a lot of sympathy. He doesn't have a lot of empathy. Sympathy is when you say, I'm so sorry for you. Empathy is when you say, I know how that feels.
Yes, which he does get, which to his credit, you know, showcasing by shows like Sandman, the TV version, and like his more modern work, he does get better at. But during the Sandman, it is very much that like typical 80s, like pitying, condescending, like, I understand how hard it is for you to live.
And like, to be clear, this was not necessarily something endemic to him with comics of the time. I've read a lot of Vertigo comics, and a lot of them like to use people who are different as an example of like, wow, isn't this a fucked up and kind of dark story? And it's like, this is, in the attempt to create comics for adults, we just managed to create comics that don't treat people like adults.
Well, it's,
and that fucking sucks.
Yeah, well, it's the Oscar sort of thing too. It's like, oh, look how deep we are. We're going to award Best Picture to a movie that acknowledges that like racism exists or transphobia exists or homophobia exists, and it's going to be made by all cis white dudes who don't have that experience at all. But look at it. Look how great we are because of how deep we're being and how sympathetic we're being. Let's just all pat ourselves on the back and give ourselves awards. It's the same thing. It's the same thing here where it's just like we're adult because we're digging down deep and showcasing, you know, identities you never would have seen. They aren't allowed, but it's still being told by people not from those identities often.
I remember when Crash won Best Picture.
Yeah, or fucking Green Book just a few years ago.
Oh, right. I forgot Green Book. Wow, that's all look good in retrospect. Jesus Christ.
And we went to see it with High, and we were like, huh, interesting movie.
That was an interesting film.
Literally the next day we found out, like, oh, yeah, most of that was lies. And I was like, oh.
I've had a lot of, like, I read a thing on the internet and it immediately makes me do a 180 of my opinion of it. But, like, that was, like, literally the next day. It was like, oh, shit. Ah, fuck. You got me.
It's that thing I was saying before. It's like, well, both sides are equally problematic. You know, the dude in Green Book, if he was, they both kind of had a little racism towards each other. And if they just got over that, it would all be okay.
I think the white guy had more racism.
Just a bit. Movies like that constantly frame it that way. You know?
God. But yeah, any other thoughts about
I want to read about in general or this one specifically?
About Facade, and then after that we'll go to like the wrap up about the book in general.
I think people should do less stories where you need to know about some 60s DC character to get it.
Yeah.
Cough.
Yeah. I will say, like, I want to read the fucking story about the metamorphic Roman centurion who died in a volcano after 2,000 years. That sounded interesting. If I knew where to get those back issues at all, I would love to read that. Unfortunately, I bet there is nowhere to get those back issues.
Wait, did they, like, make those, or is that just...
I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know if that's a reference to a real story, or if that's just some shit Neil made off the dome.
I think it's some shit he made up off the dome.
Oh. Well, I want to read that story. That seems interesting.
I just want my dark deconstruction of Condiment King. That's my plan. my dark deconstruction for, like, Condiment King, like, dies by suicide at the end. It's so fucking deep. Yeah.
The streets will run red with ketchup.
In my blood.
Messed up.
Damn.
Or... catched up.
Good lord.
I wish I was heard. I must be heard, but all they hear is mustard.
I don't know if I'd relish reading that.
Oh.
Hey. Oh. Anyways. Amazing. And that was Dream Country. That was all four issues in this. We're not going to get a story this short for the rest of the run of the series. I think there are a couple books that come close. I think World's End is only 6 issues, and I think The Wake is only maybe 5, but this is the shortest volume in the series.
Maybe that's for the best, because it was kind of a wet fart, honestly.
Yeah.
I do like the comic one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or
the cat one.
Yeah, the comic one. That's the one.
I will say it's going to be interesting getting to, because this isn't the only short story collection in the Sandman series. Book 6 is going to be Fables and Reflections, which is a collection of several other short stories which ran in between, I want to say, between Cease and Desist and A Game of You, and then some that ran between A Game of You and Brief Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then World's End is kind of a collection of short stories with a framing device around it. Okay. So we're going to still see more one-shots, more stories like this that are views of the world the Sandman takes place in from the perspective of somebody on the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, again, like, some of them are better than others. There's definitely a few that are, like, I still remember as being stone-cold bangers. And there are a few that I am not looking forward to getting to.
Oh, boy.
Some of them are both. Like, while Ramadan has some of my favorite art in the entire run of Sandman, it's P. Craig Russell, like, knocking it out of the fucking park on it.
I'm scared based on that name.
Yeah, it's Neil Gaiman writes about basically his spin on Thousand and One Nights, and it's like,
oh boy,
yeah. There's much to think about with that one, but we'll be getting to that in due time. Cool, but yeah, overall, if you're just going for the short version of reading through Sandman, none of these are necessarily essential. But
yeah, I would say read Dream of Cats.
Dream of Cats is cool. If you read two, Dream of Cats and Midsummer Nights, both of those are neat.
I actually do think Midsummer Nights actually does like get referenced in the future.
Yeah.
Oh, does it? Okay.
I said, there's another issue I think in book 10, The Tempest, that is about Shakespeare at the end of his life and him talking about concluding the deal that he made with Dream and wondering if it really was all worth it.
Hmm. Okay. So,
and that storyline's actually carried over into other non-penned by Neil Gaiman comics. Like, if we actually do end up continuing this series past the stuff that Neil wrote, the series Waking Hours, published recently by G. Willow Wilson, actually gets back in
it.
Yeah, it gets back into the whole Shakespeare thing about a lady trapped in a coma with a whole bunch of different representations of Shakespeare, with her trying to figure out which one is the, quote, correct one to try to escape her dreams. It's actually, like, there's some really interesting stuff going on there. G. Willow Wilson's actually a really good Cape Comics writer. I dig her stuff a lot. But, yeah, that was Dream Country.
It certainly was a collection of comics that you can read with your eyeballs.
Definitely was a collection of comics, most yes. assuredly.
Panels arranged in sequence with words. Mm-hmm.
They sure are.
Thanks for joining me, you two. It's even when the comics are mid, it is always a blast to talk with you about them.
Yeah. What is what's next?
Next is Season of Mists.
Mm-hmm.
The it's a more bigger structured storyline type thing where Dream, through shenanigans, ends up getting the key to hell, and he has to decide what to do with it.
Also, remember
that subplot featuring his girlfriend who he condemned to hell for a billion years? That comes back up and gets resolved. So
I see.
Get ready for that.
I actually really like that storyline. Yeah.
Season of Mists might be my favorite Sandman story.
I'm excited to get into it.
It's cool.
Okay.
My favorite is A Game of You. Despite that one's very problematic stuff, I actually really like that one a lot.
That's fair. Yeah, and I'm excited to get into A Game of You because, you know, it's been a while since I've read it, and I want to read it from my significantly different perspective than where I was when I was a teenager. I will say I think that when I was a teenager and I read Game of You, that was one of the first times I realized that trans people existed. So it was a very different time for small Iris, for small dead name.
It's definitely got its problems, but I think less so than many others of its contemporaries, and actually some of the stuff that other people critique about it, I actually kind of like. So we will talk about it when we get there. So
yeah, I'm excited to
hear that. Hot takes incoming.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Piping hot. Anyways, thank you for joining us tonight on Sand Job. We appreciate your patronage. You can find us on the web at sandjob.xyz. We also have a Twitter at SandJobPod, and also we are on co-host at SandJobPod on there. Feel free to subscribe to us through any of your better podcast catching apps. I know we're on like Spotify and Stitcher and Google and all that other stuff. I applied to a whole bunch of them, and I know that we got on a bunch. So if you just search for Sand Job, you'll probably find us.
Make sure you have the explicit filter turned on, though.
Because yes.
Sometimes they're like, ooh, you say fuck too much. And I'm like, well, fuck. What can I fucking do about that?
Yeah. We are for adults, just as these comics are. If you're like 12 years old, maybe don't read these comics either. These are pretty intense. They do say for mature readers only on the back.
it's for adults, as we say. Yeah.
What were your recommendations this time?
Oh, right, yeah. I'm Iris J. You can find me at irisj.net or Iris J Comics on Twitter, Tumblr, Mastodon, Pillowfort, and co-host. My recommendation for this time is, I don't know if you've heard about this, but coming out pretty, well, I'm not going to say soon, but coming out in the future, there's this remarkable film called Identities that a really good friend of mine made. So I'm going to recommend that you sign up through the link I'm going to be placing in the show notes to Nebula, the TV service that is funding it. It's an online service that helps. It's created and owned by YouTube people, and it's like YouTube, but it's just the YouTube people, and they make content on it, and there's no ads and no stupid-ass comments. And sometimes they put stuff on there that isn't anywhere else. And this is going to be a film that's one of them. It has people from television in it. And it's very good. It's going to be a compelling cyberpunk narrative about gender, the tech industry, and about pushing against the restraints that we are filed into by society.
Wow, and this is really cool hearing the pitch of my own film.
This is the pitch I've been given to people. I know. I did a little art for it. What's the link for it? It's like nebula.tv/signup/identities.
It's not very conducive, but it's go.nebula.tv/identities. IDENTITEAZE.
Yes. So,
and also you get to see Iris's very sexy art on the page.
I did a little art for it. Jesse is the brains behind the operation, so you should
give it a look. Art. I we're doing like production design shit now, and I'm like, I just make the costumes that Iris did. just make those jumpsuit things. Make that.
Oh, just cool. Do that.
Yeah. Hell also, yeah. If you sign up to Nebula, you can subscribe to see Jesse's other video content that she puts out, which is cool, which I do. Oh,
thank you.
Hell yeah. You just put up a whole bunch about trans art, which was really nice.
Hell yeah.
Ooh.
Anyways.
And also some darker ones, too, which is sad, because the world sucks the moment for trans people, but we get through.
It sure does, but we'll get through
it. We'll get through it.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, Jesse, sorry. What did you want to recommend? I'm sorry if I sniped yours.
What did you? No, you're great. You're just recommending my own thing. It was awesome. What do I want to recommend? You know what? Because I just finished it and I haven't had a huge chance to talk about it. Dark. I would recommend the TV show Dark, which is a Netflix show that was made in Germany, and it is a time travel series. It takes place over the course of 3 seasons. But what's really cool about it is, you can tell that they planned out the entirety of the series right from the beginning, because the way the time travel works is, it is one of those things where, like, time travel doesn't change things. Everything that was supposed to happen does happen, but it's the characters kind of going back and forth through multiple different time periods as you go through it, and you start to realize, like, characters are the parents of other characters who have gone back in time and gotten stuck there, and this person's related to this person, and I just love the way that they get the motivations down, because you see characters meet their older selves, and they start to, like, fight. They're like, I need to take down my older self, because his desire is different than my desire, and then you're sort of like, that's interesting, so then how does he get to be his older self and have like a completely different like goal and motivation? And then when you get to those points, you're like, oh, I totally see why he makes like that decision to get to that point where like he changes his motivation. Like it justifies all of that when you're like, that makes no sense. Like, why would he do the same thing again if he knows that he's going to want to fight himself later on? And then you're like, oh, that actually works really, really well. It's just one of those really well plotted out shows, and it will hurt your brain by the end because it gets way more complicated than you think it will. And it's already pretty damn complicated in the first season. So yeah, it is a really like twisty, mind bendy show that is very intelligent and talks about like themes of determinism and do we have any free will? Can we actually make decisions for ourselves? And yeah, I think it's a really cool series.
That's neat. Cool. I've had a couple people recommend Dark to me before. They've had nothing but good things to say about it, so I really should check it out.
It is all very I know good. Is
it's got music from Agnes Obel. I think she did like the opening song or something.
It's a good song. It's a great song. Yeah, it's a great show, but like prepare to take notes when you watch. It's very complicated.
Oh yeah. Our friends upstairs are trying to get us to watch Lost, and it's like, well, I gotta.
Oh, it's Lost. Lost isn't even that bad. Like, this is much worse than Lost. Lost is. I, as someone who loves Lost, I own the entire DVD box set. I love that show. That show is intentionally just like, here's a bunch of weird shit. But the characters are really well done, so you're okay with it. This Dark is actually good characters, and like the plot makes sense from the jump. It's just the way it unfolds is very complicated and requires you to like think four dimensionally.
Cool. Check it out. And Nero, how about you? Plug your pluggables, as they say.
Nero, you can find my stuff at itsnero.com unless you're under 18, and if you're under 18, why are you here? I started a webcomic recently that's about two men who are awful for each other, about punching and BDSM. I was going to recommend, though, Dave McKean's Cages that Iris has a giant copy of. It's very much the opposite of a thing you need to take notes on. It's pretty much entirely a vibes piece, but it's got some incredible art in it. It's very long, though, but if you want something to just sit and, like, drink, like, three mugs of tea while reading, like, definitely recommend that.
I'm smiling so hard right now. I'm so glad you got to read Cages. Cages rules. Yeah. It's one of my... It
took me two nights, but I did it.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite graphic novels. It's the story is like, whatever. But the art in it is so good. Dave McKean does like multimedia stuff in it. Even just his inking. I love the way he inks. It's such this weird, like, expressionist, scratchy pen style. And like,
yeah.
The way he caricatures people makes them look so off kilter. It's just so I want to climb inside your brain.
It's a really good example of he's very good at drawing people where they can look different from panel to panel, but you know exactly who they are because there's like certain features that are consistent.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's some really smart cartooning. The dude's a wizard.
Yeah. I'm glad they got I'm still wilded out that they got him for all of the covers for Sandman, but they never got him to do any sort of interior comics at all.
I wonder if he just didn't want to.
Maybe. I mean, he did work with Neil on a couple of stories before this, but maybe he was just like, I don't want that kind of time commitment. That's a lot of content to put out in a short time. I don't know, but would have been cool. We'll kind of get to something vaguely like that. Like, we get to see Bill Sienkiewicz and Baron Story do short stories for the Endless Nights collection.
How far 11. Away is that?
That is far.
Fuck. I love his shit. I love Bill Sienkiewicz.
Oh, my God. He does Delirium Story, and you gotta roll with me.
Oh.
It's a really good one, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Each story in Endless Nights is about a different member of the Endless, and that one's like the Delirium one. It legit kicks ass. It's really good.
Oh no, I'm looking at it. Oh no. Okay. I'll shield my eyes. I'll keep myself from being spoiled. I'll wait.
I'm so sorry. But yeah, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Sand Job. Oh yeah, email. Email us at, what is it, like mail@sandjob.xyz? Sure.
Should be.
Yeah, email us if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or talk to us on the social media. So we love hearing that. Until next time, folks, have a good evening and sweet dreams to you all.
Mm-hmm.